Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2019, today's guest, Chase Aboudin, won his race for San Francisco District Attorney with a plan to end mass incarceration and reform a legal system that disproportionately punishes Black and brown people and low-income people. Running for DA was his first political race. In his victory speech, he said, quote, "The movement we built must demand that San Francisco's District Attorney's office makes the city safer for all of us." Here is part of his speech.
It must demand that San Francisco make it easier to get help than it is to get high on our streets. Yeah. It must demand that we stop using the jail as the primary place to treat people suffering from mental illness. It must demand that we test every single rape kit that we built. The movement must demand police accountability. Yeah. Ending racial disparities at every step of the criminal justice system.
That is San Francisco District Attorney Chase Aboudin giving his victory speech in 2019. He was sworn in on January 8th, 2020. The next year, on January 2nd, 2021, Richie Greenberg, a former Republican mayoral candidate, began a petition to recall D.A. Aboudin and registered the domain name recallchaseaboudin.org. The recall effort was successful, and on June 7th, San Francisco voters will decide whether or not Chase Aboudin will keep his job. Recall supporters say he is, quote, failing to keep San Franciscans safe. They are blaming him for the addiction crisis, home burglaries, auto break-ins, and other societal problems. Recall supporters have raised over $6 million, according to the city's official numbers. Ads online and TV are being paid for by a group called Neighbors for a Better San Francisco, which has contributed nearly $1.8 million to the recall effort. The vast majority of the neighbors' money comes from 20 donors, according to 48 Hills. Some of them do not live in San Francisco. Virtually all of them have made their money in tech, venture capital, or real estate. William Obernorf, a hedge fund manager who has contributed more than $600,000 to the Neighbors PAC, is a charter school proponent and gave more than $1 million to Republican Senator Mitch McConnell's PAC in 2020, according to the San Francisco Examiner. Other recall supporters include the United Democratic Club and the Chinese American Democratic Club. If Chase Aboudin is recalled, his replacement will be appointed by San Francisco Mayor London Breed. Those opposed to the recall have raised almost $2 million. They include the ACLU of Northern California, the Chinese Progressive Action Fund, the San Francisco Labor Council, United Educators of San Francisco, and the California Nurses Association. The San Francisco Chronicle's editorial board also opposes the recall, writing, quote, "Crime stats that mirror those of when Aboudin took office do not justify a recall. Violent crime is low and has stayed low, even as it has surged across the country at rates not seen since the 1960s. Property crime rates were unacceptable before Aboudin arrived, and they're unacceptable now. San Franciscans have a right to be outraged, but prematurely sacking the district attorney will not be a magic fix." Joining us to talk about the recall and to take your questions is San Francisco District Attorney Chase Aboudin. Hi, D.A. Aboudin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Good to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you. We first want to extend our condolences on the loss of your mom, Kathy, who passed on May 1st from cancer. She was 78, a member of the Weather Underground, and spent 22 years behind bars for taking part in a robbery that killed three people. According to reports, she was an unarmed getaway driver. You have a lot of experience personally with the prison system. And I mean, your father just got out of prison on November 4th after 40 years. How has this experience shaped your views on the system in this country?
Well, thanks for the condolences, Rose. It's never easy to lose a parent, and particularly difficult timing for our family. I don't remember when my parents got arrested. I was 14 months old. I don't remember when the judge sentenced them, my mom to 20 years to life, my dad to 75 years to life. My earliest memories are waiting in lines at prison gates to go through metal detectors, just to be able to see my parents, to give them a hug. And even before I understood what mass incarceration was or what the criminal justice system was, I noticed as a child that the lines to get into those prisons were mostly Black and brown women and children. And so over the years and now decades of visiting jails and prisons, I learned that our country's approach to public safety was failing us. It wasn't rehabilitating people who had committed crimes. Instead, we had a revolving door. It wasn't investing meaningfully in supporting victims of crime. Instead, they were told to be satisfied with a punitive form of justice. And it was so expensive that it was bankrupting our local governments of the resources needed desperately to invest in things that actually make our communities safe and vibrant. Things like housing and education and employment opportunities. And so I dedicated my career to trying to fight for a better system, a system that actually makes us safe in the long run, and that actually helps and supports those who've been harmed by crime.
You know, you mentioned a couple stats, and I just wanted to find some statistics to look at where we are today. And according to the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, San Francisco disproportionately arrests African American women. According to the data, Black women compose less than 6% of San Francisco's female population, but constitute nearly half of all female arrests and experience arrest rates 13 times higher than women of other races. This came out in 2015. Is the data still the same?
Well, one thing that's important to note, Rose, and those statistics are chilling. They're horrifying. They're a reflection of the white supremacy and the deeply ingrained racism that permeate so many areas of public life and institutions. I don't control the San Francisco Police Department. And so changing policies and practices of the police department is a huge, huge challenge. It's something that falls directly on Chief Scott, the police commission. I can only influence their policies at the edges. The short answer to your question is that, yes, the statistics continue to mirror those that you just read. The racial disparities in San Francisco when it comes to who gets stopped, particularly for things like broken taillights or expired registration, are among the worst racial disparities in the state. And that's why back in February of 2020, when I first took office, I implemented a policy that declined to prosecute cases stemming from pretextual traffic stops. I was trying to push the police department in ways that the Obama Department of Justice massive report and recommendations had not succeeded in doing, in ways that decades of data published by the ACLU, by other advocacy groups, had not succeeded in getting the police department to change. We still have work to do, and we need a district attorney who is both committed to holding people who commit crimes accountable and also to restoring the trust that the public has in the integrity of our justice system by doing the proactive work to eliminate racial disparities.
When you ran for DA, you talked a lot about wanting to change the system and ending mass incarceration. You know exactly how this system works. You knew what you were walking into. What did you want to change exactly, given how the system is set up?
Well, what we've seen, and this is a defining feature of America's approach to criminal justice, it's a revolving door. It was true in San Francisco when I took office. It's true in California, and it's true from coast to coast. We don't invest in addressing root causes of crime. And so what we've seen over decades is people cycle in and out of jails and prisons. In the state of California, for example, about two-thirds of people getting released from prison will be reincarcerated within a couple of years. In other words, we're not treating every arrest the way we should. And what I wanted to do was to make every arrest an opportunity for intervening and transforming lives away from crime. I wanted to make sure that people who are drug addicted get treatment, that people who are mentally ill get medication, and that it's court supervised and mandated in the context of a criminal case. And if folks can successfully engage with the programming and the treatment, we should give them incentives to do that. That's why under my administration, we've expanded diversion programs. It's why we've expanded access to reentry housing for folks getting released from custody. We know that if we simply punish people and ignore what happens next, that we're actually creating more crime in the future. And we've got to do a better job. That's been the approach for decades, and it has not worked. My plan, my effort, and of course, it's been dramatically complicated by the fact that the COVID pandemic shut us down just 2 months after I was sworn into office, is to treat every arrest as an opportunity for intervention.
Well, let's talk about what has happened under COVID and how that has affected people's lives. One third of Black students said there was not enough food in their home during the pandemic, according to the CDC. And the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice has a piece just a couple weeks ago. Some teens are depressed for a reason. Many are victims of domestic abuse. This is happening in their own home. And then we have, you know, inequality that was exacerbated by COVID. So what were some of the changes you saw looking at the data and then how things on the streets changed as a result?
Yeah, I mean, it's just been devastating for all of us. And, you know, as you said, the wealth inequality, access to housing, changes in the kinds of crimes that get committed, it had a massive impact. And it's changes that were driven by the COVID pandemic that the folks behind this recall are trying to exploit to channel anxiety and fear and frustration that's understandable from our residents against me and my office in ways that are really just dishonest and disconnected from the bigger picture trends in San Francisco and across the state. To give you a few examples of what we saw, right at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw an increase in domestic violence and a decrease in evidence available to prosecute domestic violence because it was happening behind closed doors, because vulnerable victims were being forced to shelter in place with their abusers. And so we jumped into action and we partnered with Airbnb, with the governor, with other city agencies to create short, medium, and long-term housing for domestic violence survivors right at the beginning of the pandemic. We also saw, thanks to the way Trump weaponized anxiety about the pandemic and targeted the Asian American community, we saw a dramatic increase in hate speech and hate crimes targeting Asian Americans, not just in San Francisco, but all across the country, in Texas, in Atlanta. And that's why we've been at the forefront of doing community-based education around identifying and preventing hate speech. It's why I convened all of the Bay Area elected district attorneys to designate a task force in our offices to prosecute hate crimes and coordinate and share information. Another really disturbing trend we saw in the beginning of the pandemic, as tourism dried up, we saw a huge decrease in auto burglaries, about a 40% decline in reported car break-ins that first year of the pandemic. But many of the people who had been committing switched over and started breaking into business and started breaking into garages or homes. Obviously, when someone breaks into our home, it is scary. It is quite literally close to home. And the law appropriately punishes residential burglaries more severely than auto burglaries. It's something that has led a lot of people in San Francisco who never used to be directly impacted by crime to start to experience it in ways that, again, have been exploited and manipulated by the proponents of this recall.
I guess what's frustrating is I've seen you interviewed many, many times, and it almost seems like you're being asked to brag about how many people you are putting in jail, which is such a simplistic conversation. And just to go over levels of crime, so let's talk about nonviolent crime, broken windows. I mean, a lot of people don't even report it because they say, what's going to happen? There's nothing's going to happen as a result. People going into Walgreens and stealing things. How should society, in your opinion, respond when we see young people of color, committing these kinds of crimes?
Well, I really appreciate the point, Rose. I mean, it's true that there's tremendous pressure from the media and from the backers of this recall to evaluate the work our office does in terms of charging rates or conviction rates or length of sentence. And those are exactly the kinds of misleading metrics that led to mass incarceration in the first place, that lead prosecutors across this country to hide evidence or to overcharge systematically in order to increase the chance of a conviction, even of an innocent person. And look, San Francisco has long had a serious problem with property crime. It's not a new problem. And actually, if you look at the data, it has not gotten worse the 2.5 years I've been in office. In fact, property crime, as reported to the police, is down about 20% during the 2.5 years I've been in office as compared to the 2.5 years prior to my administration. Now, we know a lot of that is driven by changes in the pandemic, but it's really important to remember that just because we see more videos of crime or more news reporting about crime does not mean that crime is actually up. Now, when police do make arrests, and it's important to remember, the district attorney, no matter who the district attorney is, cannot get involved, cannot prosecute, whether you believe in the death penalty and life without parole, or whether you believe in diversion and restorative justice or anything in between. We can't do it until and unless police bring us an arrest. And you mentioned theft cases, car break-ins and shoplifting. Police make arrests in those cases in San Francisco in about 2% of reported incidents. That means 98% of the time that someone reports one of those crimes, no case is ever brought to the district attorney's office for prosecution. So we need to look upstream at what we can do to prevent, at what we can do to increase effective policing. And what we are doing, especially with the young people you mentioned, is we're expanding a really successful restorative justice program called Make It Right. And I want to just own up and say I didn't start this program. I inherited it. But we've expanded it because 5 years plus of data have showed that when people, young people, are referred to this restorative justice program, they're about 40% less likely to be rearrested in the future. We need, again, remember, we need every arrest to be an opportunity to prevent future crime, especially for lower level offenses where we know people will get released, no matter how harsh we are in our punishment. Restorative justice, the Make It Right program, has been a tried and true approach to have healthy, humane interventions for young people that not only empower victims of crime, but also prevent future crime.
What happens after a young person is arrested? Is the young person asked, you know, what is home like life? What caused you to do this? Is there help available, resources available? What happens at that point?
Well, it really depends on the particular charges, the particular history of the young person. But our approach under my administration has been to treat kids as kids. So one thing that we've done, for example, I'm the only district attorney in the state to make an across the board commitment that we will never prosecute kids as adults. Certain basic things, just recognizing that kids are kids, is critical. And since I took office, we've decreased the number of juveniles in our juvenile jail 50%, because we all watched with horror as Trump separated kids from their parents at the border and put kids in cages. And we all not belong in cages. It's true at the border, and it's true in San Francisco on my watch. We're not going to jail kids as a primary response. Instead, we're going to work with amazing community partners like Sunset Youth Services to get kids not just into some kind of a program where they get a certificate, but into a community where they're loved and where they can develop an identity and where they can build self-esteem and develop job skills. That's the approach that we take whenever possible with our young kids. Let's do an assessment of their family and their home environment. And if it's not safe or supportive, let's find an alternative where they will be supported and where they can achieve their full potential. We know how much young people go on to accomplish when given a chance and when given the kind of love that so many are lucky enough to receive. When kids don't get that kind of love at home, we've got to step up and provide it for them.
Today, we're spending the hour with San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin. On June 7th, San Francisco voters will decide whether or not he will keep his job. If you have any questions or comments for DA Boudin, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Where do you stand on the recall? Do you know what his office does? Do you know what he legally is allowed to do and not do? Any basic questions just about how his office operates? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Before we get to calls, can you just tell us more for people who do not know what the DA's office does? I mean, at a time when, you know, from Fox to social media, San Francisco is going to hell under Chesa Boudin. I mean, you just see this on a pretty regular basis. What does your office actually have the authority to do?
Well, it's a great question, Rose, and I appreciate you asking it because, as you say, you know, there's millions of dollars being spent by the recall and also Fox News to make San Francisco and me in particular a national punching bag. And there's lots of reasons why Fox News and Republicans like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton have decided to support my recall and to suggest falsely to people in red states in the middle of the country that San Francisco is some kind of Mad Max post-apocalyptic dystopia. But the reality is San Francisco continues to be one of the safest cities in the country. And we have a lot of work to do to make it safer, of course. But we have to recognize that the district attorney is not responsible, not me and not any other district attorney, for things like addressing homelessness or for seeking conservatorships against people who are mentally ill. We're also not responsible for going out and responding to 911 calls or making arrests. What we do is essentially run a law office. It's a small city agency in a city with a $14 billion budget. The district attorney's office has a $75 million budget, and almost all of that money goes to paying our staff, our lawyers, our paralegals, our investigators. And what we do is we essentially take the evidence police bring us and we present it to judges and juries when we believe there's enough evidence to prove someone committed a crime. And we make recommendations to judges about what sort of sentences are appropriate, about whether or not someone we are prosecuting should be held in jail pending trial. But we don't make the ultimate decision. The judge does. And so one of the things you'll hear people say about me and about my office that's so dishonest and so dangerous because of the way in which it dumbs down what is a conversation that needs to be nuanced and as complicated as the system of checks and balances that our founders and our Constitution created. They'll say, oh, he's a catch and release DA. Well, we don't do the catching, the police do, and we don't do the releasing, the judges do, or the detention in those cases where someone is so dangerous that a judge decides to detain them, notwithstanding the presumption of innocence. We make recommendations, we make arguments, and we present evidence. And I am proud that despite court closures, despite the fact that the courts have been down to about 10% of their pre-pandemic capacity during almost my entire administration because of COVID, we have prioritized serious and violent crimes. We have moved a higher percentage of homicides and sexual assault cases forward than has ever been done in modern DA office history in San Francisco. We are providing resources to victims of crime in ways that were never done before. And we're doing all of that despite budget freezes, hiring freezes, COVID pandemics. We're meeting the needs of our communities. For example, I created the first ever property crime victim advocate team in our office. In a city that has long led the country in property crime rates, it wasn't until last year when I fought to create a property crime team amongst our victim advocates. Those kinds of changes are within our power. Increasing arrest rates, making decisions about who gets released from jail are not within our power.
Let's hear from a caller before we go to break. Let's go to Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show. Hello, Ede. Are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. As a longtime resident, lived in the Bay Area for almost over 56 years, own substantial business in the Bay Area, including San Francisco, victim of a massive embezzlement in San Francisco of $1 million from my business. All of that taken into account, I give my total support to Chesa. He's a good DA. He has the right idea. As it is, the United States has more people in prison than I said per capita, five times as many as the United States in the world. We have more people in prison than China. But the problem is not Chesa. The problem is the system that... First of all, the Board of Education was Cal for 13 years. It was free. Now it costs so much money. Only in America do we spend more money putting people in prison than would charge their struggling parents to, you know, to send their kids to school. This system is wrong, and this is really right. What do you call it? Right wing Republican recall, and nobody else can do the good job Chesa have been doing, and just I am very, very disappointed with the whole political system in San Francisco. Totally disappointed, and I would ask everybody, please support Chesa. He's a good man. He has a good idea, and it is the system. It is a crime when you bring kids to this world without education, using drugs and guns. What do you expect? What do you expect?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the call, Ede. On June 7th. June 7th, San Francisco voters will decide whether or not Chesa Boudin will keep his job. And we are spending the hour today with San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin. If you have any questions or comments, if you live in San Francisco and you'd like to talk about what your thoughts are on safety, on crime, on Chesa Boudin's mission to end mass incarceration and reform the legal system. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin. On June 7th, voters in San Francisco will decide whether or not he will keep his job. Recall supporters have raised over $6 million, according to the city's official numbers. The vast majority of the Neighbors for a Better San Francisco, which has contributed almost $2 million to the recall effort, has come from 20 donors. William Oberndorf is a hedge fund manager who contributed more than $600,000 to the Neighbors PAC. He's a charter school proponent and gave more than $1 million to Republican Senator Mitch McConnell's PAC in 2020, according to the San Francisco Examiner. D.A. Boudin, a couple people are writing in just wondering why you think so much money is being put into this recall effort. Sam says the wealthy backers of the recall must have some agenda or policy they seek that could occur if you're removed from office. Why do you believe, or what do you believe is their true objective here?
Well, thanks for the question. Yeah, obviously it's a lot of money to most of us, to see the kind of money they're spending on this. And there's a few things that I think are really important context to understand why folks like Republican billionaire Oberndorf would spend so much money trying to recall me. Let's look at the ways in which my office has done work to hold accountable those in power, right? We create a worker protection that has sued gig economy companies that systematically misclassify their employees to avoid paying minimum wage, to steal from taxpayers by avoid paying workers' compensation and unemployment insurance. And, you know, those kinds of efforts to hold those in power accountable are prosecutions of police officers for the first ever homicide charge against an on-duty police officer in San Francisco history. Effort to go after ghost gun manufacturing companies. We're holding folks in power accountable in a way that has never been done before. And the truth is, as much as these Republicans talk about accountability, they are used to and demand impunity. When a district attorney like me starts using the power of our office, not only to prosecute poor people of color, but also to hold corrupt politicians in City Hall accountable, to hold billionaires in their boardrooms accountable, it makes them very, very uncomfortable. And what we're seeing is their backlash. And it's not limited to San Francisco. This is a playbook that we're seeing from coast to coast against prosecutors who run and win on transparent campaigns committed to reforming a deeply failed criminal legal system. And when we start doing exactly the work that we promised voters we would do, work that is evidence-based, that is grounded in decades of research and science, and that is widely popular because it is more effective at keeping communities safe and at investing resources in things that are consistent with our values, we see the same playbook from coast to coast. Attacks, massive amounts of money, police union lies and fear campaigns, and recalls, not limited to San Francisco. I'm one of three district attorneys in California to face a recall in this cycle. And in Illinois, they're trying to introduce a law that would make it possible to recall just one person in the state of Illinois, the progressive, reform-minded district attorney in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It's a playbook, and we're asking San Franciscans not to be conned by their lies and by their fear-mongering, by their exploitation of tragedies and victims. We're asking you to vote no on Proposition H today or any day between now and June 7th.
The recall supporters, again, have raised over $6 million. Those opposed have raised almost $2 million. They include the ACLU of Northern California, the San Francisco Labor Council, California Nurses Association, and United Educators of San Francisco. Let's take a few calls, and then we'll get to some emails. We'll try to get as many questions as we can. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Thank you, and I'm sorry for your loss. And I'm a 70-year-old woman, lived third-generation San Franciscan, and I just committed a felony. Years ago, and I have a question for my district attorney. Years ago, a woman named Kamala Harris became district attorney. And when she was in, who then went on to become Attorney General of California, then U.S. Senator, she's now our vice president for people who accept the election results. What she did was to lay it on the line when she was DA to the SFPD to say to the police, if it's marijuana, you don't prosecute. Then she became the author of the MORE Act, which just passed the U.S. House of Representatives, I think it's 214 to 206, to legalize marijuana in this country. Now, Chesa Boudin, I hear you say words such as low-level offenses, substance, contraband, but do you support the legalization of marijuana as on a national level, because this disproportionately affects Black people? And then on a local level, with property crime, some of the smash-and-grab burglaries have affected the cannabis dispensaries, and I am concerned about their safety. And I do not want London Breed, our fascist in the mayor's office, to be appointing anybody because she's notoriously anti-marijuana.
Thank you, Mary. D.A. Boudin, will you address those two questions?
Sure thing. First of all, I absolutely support decriminalization of marijuana. We know, as Mary said, what a horrific and shameful history of racist enforcement marijuana laws have, and we know the medicinal properties that marijuana has. So yes, I support legalization. And the other point that for folks who weren't familiar that Mary was making is that if the recall against me were to succeed, voters would not be able to choose who their district attorney is. The mayor would choose the replacement. And so many folks, even folks who may have differences of opinion with me or with my policies, are voting no on Proposition H because they want in the 2023 election to be able to choose the best candidate for the job. And they want that choice to be made by the voters, not through a behind closed doors appointment process in City Hall.
And what about Mary's question about smash and grabs? She was talking about dispensaries, but we know that this is happening beyond dispensaries.
Absolutely. Thanks for that, Rose. And thank you, Mary, for that second part of your question. Look, we need our small businesses to be able to survive and thrive in San Francisco. I know that the last 2 years have been devastating for all of our small businesses. Huge changes in commercial activity because of the COVID pandemic and an increase during the pandemic in break-ins that devastated our small businesses. And right as we were opening back up at the end of the pandemic, not that we're out of the woods yet, but right as we began to reopen, frivolous lawsuits started getting filed exploiting the Americans with Disabilities Act and targeting so many of our immigrant-owned small businesses in particular. I'm really proud of the work my office has done to support our small businesses. And I want to just give you three concrete examples of what we've done. First of all, at the beginning of the pandemic, we created a pilot project in District 5 with Supervisor Preston to reimburse small businesses for any out-of-pocket expenses they suffered as a result of storefront vandalism or break-ins. That project was so successful that it expanded and is now a citywide reimbursement program. Second thing we've done is we've continued to vigorously prosecute commercial burglaries when police bring them to us and to really prioritize our efforts around protecting merchant corridors, including in one case, for example, where someone was targeting Asian-owned businesses on Ocean Avenue. And when the police finally made an arrest, we were able to charge that suspect with dozens of burglaries, vandalisms, and hate crimes allegations. The third thing that I want to mention is something we've done just in the last couple of months after a lengthy investigation by my team. And that is we filed both a civil enforcement action and a criminal case against some of the lawyers who were illegally targeting small businesses and shaking them down for money under the auspices of the Americans with Disabilities Act or ADA. But in reality, these were lawyers who had no interest in vindicating the rights or the accessibility of the disabled, but we're simply interested in lining their own pockets at the expense of our hardworking small businesses. I will continue to fight for our small businesses, for our business leaders, and for our merchant corridors.
Thank you for the question, Mary. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes, good morning. I haven't heard it discussed at all that Chesa Boudin traveled through Latin America and wrote a book called Gringo, and I was wondering how this experience shaped his views towards criminal justice. Has there been any influence? And can you tell us how those experiences have changed his view at all of criminal justice and et cetera? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Harry. Before I was in law school, it's true, I traveled throughout Latin America. I was in Chile on a Rotary International scholarship. And during the time I was doing research for my master's degree at Oxford on a Rhodes scholarship, I spent time in Venezuela and in other parts of Northern South America. I would say the most significant thing that I learned from the years of travel and writing and research in Latin America was Spanish language. And it's a tremendously important part of my ability to engage with many of the communities we serve in San Francisco. And of course, also my wife, who is half Chilean, and to be able to interact with her Spanish-speaking family is critically important on a personal level. In terms of the criminal justice system in particular, you know, most of my time in Latin America was actually before I even went to law school. But I did have occasion to visit jails and prisons in countries like Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Chile, and more. And I learned a tremendous amount about the ways in which we do things differently than other countries. Some things we do better. I think the conditions in our jails and prison are in some ways much more humane. Certainly, we generally provide access to enough food, for example. But in other ways, our approach is really inhumane. We're the only country in the world, for example, that sentences juveniles to life without parole. That's something that any other country in the world looks at and sees as barbaric and inhumane. And so I think that one of the beauties of international travel is precisely the ability to share the way we do things and to learn from the way that other folks do things. And culture and language are such a critical part of the work we do in my office. I'm tremendously proud of the work we've done in the last 2 years to increase language access. As a Spanish speaker, I know how important cultural competence and linguistic fluency are when providing services. And when I took office, we only had one Chinese-speaking victim advocate. Now we have five, and I hired and appointed the first ever Chinese-American head of our victim services division, because I want to make sure that my office is able to provide services to all of our diverse communities.
Thank you for the question, Harry. Let's go to Cornelius in San Francisco. Hi, Cornelius.
Hi, thank you for taking my call for this program and for your great questions, Rose. I live in San Francisco, and I oppose the recall of D.A. Boudin, and he's doing a great job. And I ask a question specifically of the commission, the Innocence Commission, that your office has set up, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for that question and for your support against the recall. One of the things I promised voters that we would do is create an independent Innocence Commission. And let me just take a moment and explain why that's important. You know, forensic science changes with time. The standards around sentencing and around evidentiary burdens have evolved over time as well. And we need to do justice, not only in the cases going forward, but also looking backwards. We need to do that so that the public trusts the integrity of the convictions that we secure today. And we know that in San Francisco and California and across the country, there's a shameful history of innocent people being convicted for crimes they didn't commit. And it's really problematic when this happens, not only because someone is being punished for something they didn't do, but also because it means whoever actually committed that crime got away with it, with no consequences, no accountability, that victims have been lied to and told that justice was served when, in fact, the real perpetrator escaped without any consequences. So I created a model independent Innocence Commission. It's presided over by a law professor at USF. We have a retired judge on the commission, a forensic expert, and more. And that commission has been evaluating claims of potential innocence or wrongful conviction from people in state prison out of San Francisco County. Just a few weeks ago, we successfully exonerated the first innocent case since I took office, a man named Joaquin Siria, who had been in state prison for 32 years, convicted of murdering one of his close friends under circumstances that never, ever would have been allowed to move forward to trial or conviction using today's evidentiary standards. I'm really proud of the work my Innocence Commission did in that case. I'm proud of the courage and the integrity that Mr. Syria had in maintaining his innocence for 32 years, even under tremendous pressure from the parole board and the powers that be to admit guilt for a crime he didn't commit. And I look forward to continuing the work of our Innocence Commission to find, identify, and exonerate anyone else who is languishing behind bars for a crime they didn't commit out of San Francisco County. The integrity of our justice system depends on it.
Well, thank you, Cornelius. Let's hear next from Adam calling from the Sunset. Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Mr. District Attorney. My question has to do with the drug issue that the city is confronting right now. I'm a lifelong resident of San Francisco, and I've never seen an epidemic like this in my lifetime. And one of the real concerns that I have in that your hesitancy to incarcerate, we've created a situation where we're dealing with 1,800 overdoses within the last 3 years. You have a lot of parents that are very aggrieved, and I'm sure as a parent yourself, you can really understand why. Now you have some very active victims groups that are being more and more vocal. Understandably, they should. They're mothers and fathers that have lost a loved one. What they're seeing is that those dealers, many of whom, by the way, are being arrested by SMPD. You can read the police logs in the various districts, such as the TL. They're arresting 25, 30, 40 per week. But those dealers are right back on the street. They're not staying in for long. Many times they're arrested over and over and over again. What would you say to a parent that's pleading with you, saying, please take the person that is preying on my child, please get them off the street on a permanent basis? What would your answer be to them?
Well, thanks so much for your question. And you're a neighbor of mine in the Sunset district where I live with my wife and my son, as you mentioned. And you're absolutely right to point out the devastating toll that the drug overdose epidemic has wreaked on our communities and on our families. It's not limited to San Francisco. Sadly, this is a problem we see all across the country as fentanyl has become more prevalent. And it's true not just in places with progressive reform-minded DAs, but also in places with a traditional tough-on-crime drug warriors. You know, in Riverside County, for example, in California, the DA is prosecuting drug dealers for murder when someone dies of an overdose. And that hasn't been an effective way to decrease the accessibility of drugs or the prevalence of drug overdoses. I think the heart of your question gets at the absolute tragedy and devastation that so many families feel when someone they love dies of an overdose. And I share that outrage, and I want to do everything in my power to prevent fatal overdoses and to make sure that it is easier to get help than it is to get high in San Francisco. And that's something that I said in the clip that Rose played from 2019, and we have work to do. So I want to talk about what that looks like. And I want to give you three concrete steps that I think the city needs to take. And then I want to briefly just share some of the data, because some of the things in your question were a little bit off, and I want to make sure folks know what the actual facts are. So the first thing is we need a safe consumption site. People do not die of overdoses when they're consuming drugs in safe consumption sites. The second thing we need is treatment on demand, and that can be connected to safe consumption sites, but we need it to be accessible to people when they're ready to get help, when they're ready to reduce their dependence on deadly drugs. San Francisco has to have a place for them to go to get those services, and right now we simply don't. And the third thing is we need more effective law enforcement responses. Now, you said 40 arrests a week. That's not what we see. We see about 2 arrests per day, or 14 per week, citywide, involving drug sales or possession with intent to sell. Now, if you walk through the Tenderloin, you will see dozens of drug sales in just an hour stroll through the neighborhood. But we are only being brought by police 2 arrests per day citywide for drug sales. Now, I am not suggesting that dramatically increasing the rate of arrest is going to solve the problem, but we need to recognize the scope of the issue and the limited law enforcement resources available to deal with it. And we need to remember the recent history of the failed war on drugs. The notion that simply putting people in jail for a few days or months longer, or that deporting people who are arrested for drugs is going to solve the problems in the Tenderloin is a demonstrably false notion. And I can tell you why, because at various points in the last 4 years and going back further, the San Francisco Police Department has teamed up with our federal prosecutors who don't abide by our sanctuary city law. And they've handed over non-citizen arrestees for drug sales to federal authorities. And after almost every single one of those arrests, sometimes more than a dozen at a time in big busts, the feds prosecute them, jail them, and then deport them. Surely if harsh punishment, if lengthy incarceration were going to change the human devastation and misery that we see in the Tenderloin, we would have noticed a difference after each of those busts, after each of those mass deportations. But we didn't see a difference. And public health officials tell us that that approach is actually more likely to lead to fatal overdoses. That is an ineffective way to deal with the very, very problem that you're flagging for us. Another thing that's important for folks to know, and this may come as a surprise, and I know there's many of my supporters who oppose the war on drugs who may be frustrated by what I'm about to tell you, but because the only real tool in my tool belt is prosecuting the cases police bring me, and because I share your outrage at the toll the fentanyl crisis is taking on our communities and families, I have prosecuted a higher percentage of drug sales arrests than my predecessor did during his, and than any other category of case that police bring us. We are filing nearly 90% of the felony drug arrests that police bring us. There's no other category of crime that we initiate criminal proceedings in at a higher rate. It's not working for the same reasons the war on drugs has never worked. We need effective public health responses to decrease the demand for drugs in the first place.
Well, thank you for the call, Adam, and we'll definitely do a series of shows about this. A piece I just found from the Chronicle a couple weeks ago reports that 49 people died in April in San Francisco from accidental overdoses, and then there's really incredible reporting on the prevention overdose prevention center in New York, and they have already averted many deaths. So we'll definitely dive into that. D.A. Boudin, we're almost out of time, but I think this is also an important fact. Mission Local has a piece about the SFPD rate of solving crimes, and it's below the national average. SFPD's crime clearance rates have dropped to its lowest level in a decade. Only 8.1% of reported crimes in 2021 led to an arrest. That is the lowest it's been in the past 10 years. This is according to Acting President Cindy Elias. What explains this?
You know, police have a difficult job, and I have tremendous admiration for law enforcement officers who serve with pride and with integrity. And we know that in the last couple of years, their job has gotten harder for a number of reasons. One is, a lot of the work they do involves trying to identify people who committed crimes, and they use videos to do it. And if everybody's wearing masks, it makes it much harder. Another reason is that the chief of police and others in city government, not including myself, came out in support of defunding the police. And so I think there was some morale issues when the chief of police himself says we should defund the police. And a final reason that I think is really important to remember is that a huge percentage of what police in San Francisco do is not actually respond to violent crimes in progress, but respond to public health crises, to mental health emergencies, to drug overdoses. And I really want to see a San Francisco Police Department that is both a model for reform and for eliminating racial disparities and unnecessary use of force, and that is also effective at responding to investigating and solving crimes. Because remember, I can't prosecute people. I can't hold them accountable until and unless police bring me a case. And in the 2.5 years I've been in office, we've seen fewer cases presented to the DA's office than in any other comparable period in San Francisco history. It's, if you're a baseball fan as I am, it comes down to how many swings at the pitch you get. And we're getting fewer and fewer every year. We've got to solve that problem. I don't oversee the police department. I don't oversee their budget or their training. But I know that for San Francisco to be safe, for my office, no matter who runs it, to do a good job holding people accountable and uplifting victims and securing restitution, it has to start with solid police work and investigations that lead to arrests of people who committed crimes. And I'm committed to working with our police department to make sure that they can do a better job in the years ahead, than they've been able to do in the last couple of years solving crimes.
And yet, a final comment from Shannon, who has been a victim of crime, says, I am fed up with all of the crime and all of the gentle handling of criminals. She says she's planning to vote against you. This is a common sentiment that we hear out there, that you are gentle on criminals. So how would you respond to that?
Well, if you just look at the data, you'll see that we're charging criminal cases at a higher rate than my predecessor did. And we've secured convictions in a higher percentage of our homicide cases than my predecessor did. We're not being gentle. What we're doing is we're using data and evidence-based approaches to reduce future crime and to marshal limited resources to focus on the crimes that affect the most people the most seriously. I'm so sorry for what you've experienced, Shannon. I would encourage you to reach out to me or my office directly. I'd love to make right whatever happened to you, and let's look into whether the police actually brought us a case to prosecute. I hope you'll reconsider your vote and let me finish the job San Franciscans elected me to do by voting no on Prop H today or any day until June 7th.
June 7th is the election day. San Francisco voters will decide whether or not Chesa Boudin will keep his job. San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Have a good day.
Thank you. And again, recall supporters have raised over $6 million. Those opposed to the recall have raised almost $2 million. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We will also continue to do shows about what public safety actually means, what it means to end mass incarceration and reform a legal system that disproportionately punishes Black and brown people and low-income people. If you have any show ideas or guest ideas, we'd love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. Thanks to B. Saul for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with world-renowned sleep researcher Dr. Sarah Mednick. She'll discuss her new book, The Power of the Downstate, Recharge Your Life Using Your Own Body's Restorative Systems. Well, we thought about honestly rescheduling the show because so much is going on, but we thought it's really needed. How can we bring ourselves back to the downstate through our recovery systems? This is Your Call. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar.